Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. Got a few conferences coming up, February 8th through the 9th in Sacramento, a conference on sexuality and gender. You can attend live if you're in the Sacramento area or attend virtually if you have an internet connection. We also have, of course, our Theology in the Raw Exiles in Babylon conference in March 31st through April 2nd. All the information for that conference, the Theology in the Raw conference, is on my website, pressandsprinkle.com. And the info for the sexuality conference and other events like webinars and so on are at centerforfaith.com/ events. That's right. Just go to centerforfaith.com/events. My guest today is David Bennett. David is smarter than all of you and myself combined. He has a couple degrees from Oxford University, a master's degree from St. Andrews, under where he studied under Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, and he's pursuing his doctorate back at Oxford University. He's from Sydney, Australia. He was a atheist gay activist who met Jesus in a pub, wrote a book about it called The War of Loves. I would highly encourage you to check out that book if you've not read it yet. It's an amazing book. And he's an amazing guy. He's a friend, he's a scholar, and he is a wildly charismatic Anglican-ish, Catholic-ish Christian who defies all the boxes and stereotypes. Please welcome back to the show the one and only David Bennett. Hey David, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back. It's been a year now?
At least a year
and a half.
I think it was shortly after you released your book, wasn't it? Like maybe 6 months after or something. It's been a couple years.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if we were locked down or if it was way before that, but you know, in these times our memories are a bit
what day is
scattered.
It? What year is it? Well, I don't like to have on guests too many times. Like I like to diversify and everything, but every month I'm like, I would be very happy with you being like a monthly reoccurring guest. That kind of violates the norms of podcasting, but I just love talking to you. I love your voice. I love your nuance. I love your, you can't put David Bennett in a box. Like you just challenge and encourage people across the spectrum, and I love that about you. So anyway, thanks for making time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, and thanks for what you do as well. I think, you know, the center that you've started and everything is something I recommend to so many people.
Awesome. Because
it just hits that target for me, so it's wonderful to be part of it.
Thank you. You look well. You look happy. You. Are you happy right now? I mean, because there's
so
a lot of
happy.
Stuff to not be happy about in this world we're living in, but
I think I've finally got able, after 2 years of being locked down in the UK and not being able to get back to my family. It was quite tough. The Australian government locked the country down and you couldn't even come back as a citizen. Which I think being in the UK, it had a psychological effect on me. It was pretty rough to like go through the last 2 years with all of its downsides and then be kind of, you know, isolated from your family, from your support structure, trying to do a doctorate. It was not easy. So I've definitely had some difficult moments, but I'm kind of on the other side of it, able to be with the family, have a good Christmas, refill the tanks, which has been really brilliant. And I'm just here looking out at Sydney Harbour, hard life, you know. so I'm grateful to have that respite. I think in this time we're all auditing our lives and saying what really matters, what are the foundational things we need to value and invest in. And I think one of the really interesting things for me has been how important family is, as well as a celibate gay Christian. Like I've really needed to just be with my family and friendship helps and it's good. But there's that kind of kinship need when the world is in crisis. So it's taught me a lot about my own voice and my own message with the Lord. Mm-hmm. And I think there'll be some different content coming eventually as I reflect on the last 2 years.
I was joking with a buddy of mine who's about my, I'm 46. We both looked at each other. I think it might have been, maybe not a buddy of mine. I think it was maybe Russell Moore or somebody on the podcast recently. And we looked at each other and said, can you imagine if we had Twitter when we were teenagers? The stuff I would have to go back and scrub. Like, I would have been canceled like 10 times old. Like, oh my word. I mean, 10 years ago. I mean, I'm glad I got on Twitter like 10 years ago and not like before that. But wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the other thing that's been really tough in this season is the conversion therapy laws, one that was passed in Victoria. And obviously I'm against conversion therapy. That's why you're a side B Christian, because you think conversion therapy is a false option. That shouldn't be the way, that there is damage done in that context of, but then when conversion therapy is turned back on you as a celibate gay Christian, you're told teaching celibacy is a suppression practice by your state or your government, which is probably going to come all around the kind of Western world.
Is it they're casting the umbrella, like any kind of side B view of things is going to be labeled conversion therapy? Like, are they using that label so broadly?
It's the fact that I even have to make that distinction. Like, it's the fact that I even have to say, as a gay man, if I choose to be celibate and follow the traditional teaching of scripture in the church, that I am suppressing myself. And then if I try to teach anyone about that individually and help them in prayer, like, I mean, I don't really pray over people anyway. It's because I pray with someone that's in, like, wants to pray about that and who needs support. It could just be like a gay mate that I meet, you know, that I friend that I just, you know, is journeying. Just to know that that could be turned back on me as a suppression practice, it's just traumatizing. Like, it's like deeply scary, you know. And I think for a lot of straight people in the church, like, oh, well, I'm never going to do that. I'll just get on with it. I might believe what the Bible teaches, but I don't need any pastoral ministry. I'm not a gay person, so it's fine. And like, that can just be like really tough, that kind of indifference you sense in people, like, well, yeah, conversion therapy is wrong, so it should be outlawed. It's like, well, conversion therapy should be discouraged and called out for what it is, but you don't just remove something by banning it. You remove it by producing a better alternative that works and that is humane, that is loving, that is biblical, you know. That stress has been tough for me. And then on top of that, watching many of the churches attached to the UK, like Church of England, going with gay marriage and just like watching dominoes fall. And then seeing the scandals in the evangelical world. It's a lot, I think, for especially the gay celibate community that's trying to trust the church, you know, that is orthodox. And yet constantly going through that trust being broken, seeing our own weakness as human beings as well, and then having secular states totally disregard us and not consult us in laws that actually directly affect us, it's really hard to articulate how hard that is.
That's wild.
I don't know what you think, Preston, whether I'm being overly dramatic or whether I'm interpreting that in the wrong way. I just don't know how to respond. I feel like overwhelmed.
I mean, no, I think you have every right to be. I don't have any. My only thing with here's what I wrestle with the scandals in evangelicalism. Kind of like if you thought about American evangelicalism and just you let your mind wander, like what picture would come up in your head and how much of that is shaped by a really, well, it's, I don't know. Like the scandals are, you know, these big leaders who are publicized and everything, but there are, this is just anecdotal. So like you, I go and speak at a lot of different churches. Some of them are big churches, 5,000-10,000 people. Stars and lights and fog machines and all this stuff. And I'm just, in my anecdotal experience, I come across godly, humble, non-misogynistic, gracious, forgiving, confessing, leaders of mega churches all the time. They're not known. They don't write books, whatever. But like, I go from church to church, you know, and I see all this great stuff. And then when people think American evangelicalism or even mega church and the platform and all this stuff, it's just nothing but negativity. And I don't want to downplay the reasons why they have that view. I mean, I have the same stuff. I'm like, gosh, yet another leader fell. But I wonder how much of that is shaped by the fact that we always hear about the scandals. Those are front and center. We don't hear about the pastor who grew a church out of a living room and now he's got 5,000 people coming and he walks around and talks to people. He knows hundreds of people by name, even though he's at a mega church. Like, I'm thinking one in particular that I spoke at recently. You know, he might write a book someday, but he's not well known not that well known outside of his circles and stuff. And there's just a lot of that. So I battle with you. I battle a certain level of pessimism. Like, my gosh, you know, yet another one fell, or just like, or you just hear stuff and you look at social media and, or, you know, I was driving today. You'll appreciate this. I got to pull this up. I was going to tweet this, but I'm like, do I even want to feed the machine? Let's see if you can see this.
What does it say?
God, guns, Trump.
Yeah, I can't even. Yeah, I just like, how, you know, it's this whole populism that hijacked the German Protestant church. Yeah. It's like, how has the American Protestant church not learned the lessons of Germany? Like, how as a theologian in the 21st century, or any Christian thinker of any kind that has any knowledge of history, you know, beyond year 12 or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm stumped.
Yeah.
I don't have words. I think when Biden got elected, I just broke down. And part of that was the relief that Trump wasn't there anymore on some level, but could not leverage his voice. The other was just deep despair about the whole thing.
Yeah.
What the United States has become.
Yeah.
This populist kind of pseudo-Christian machine that is not reflective of the Lord Jesus Christ, the first century Jewish carpenter, has become a moralistic, weird, populist, like Trump equals Christianity. Like, how... It blows my mind. I understand that, like, it's complex and that the American story is complex, but it also is. Racism and just everything. Like, from an Australian perspective and a British perspective, it's just really tough to watch. I don't know how much Americans understand the effect they're having on the rest of the world that shares some of their similar values. And I'm not wanting to, like, you know, just, I mean, I love the United States. I have tons of American friends. I've received so much from people, you know, that are US based, but I just find myself perplexed. Other than don't commit idolatry, like political idolatry is basically what's happening. And how does the church resist that?
I would say, the question. For me, it doesn't seem new, because I was raised in, let's see, born in 76. So like the whole Reagan era. I mean, Reagan was, if you're a Christian, you vote for Ronald Reagan. And that was just in the culture, you know. It's definitely magnified with the Trump era. And in the last, I mean, since 2016, the polarization has gotten way more intense. And so you do have the extremes where people are completely syncretistically wedding their political allegiances with their allegiance to Christ, or try, obviously that's not possible, but that's what's happening. I think it has gotten worse, but for me, it has been there on some level. But I will say again, I mean, not just you, but like anybody listening, like when people think of that perception, are they thinking of names and faces in their local church? Maybe. Some of them are. But I do think a lot of this is living and exacerbated on social media. I mean, what, 7% of the U.S. population is like active on Twitter? And yet you go on Twitter and you think that represents the whole. And you know, I talk to conservatives, moderates, liberals, and the average person that maybe voted this direction or that direction doesn't doesn't, I don't know. Like, I've never met a, I've met tons of Trump voting Christians. I've never met a single one who was like, yay, January 6th, that was awesome. Or even like anything, but that was absolutely hideous and horrible. But then you go online and it's like, no, Republicans are like for January 6th takeover or something. It's like, what? I don't, the, in the real world on the ground, I just think that, I don't know, this might be my, I don't know, I'm just totally opinion, just anybody can dismiss it, but it seems like the average person in the pew is not as bad. And again, I'm here, the one who voted for Biden, one who voted for Trump. Not every Trump voter is a flaming racist. Not every Biden voter wants to kill babies in the womb in mass, you know? I don't know. Like, I just wonder if there is a more nuanced, quiet, hopefully majority. Maybe this is my optimism. Having said all that, David, you are, it's still bad. It's, there's a discipleship crisis in America right now. So I want to come full circle and say, no, what, you're tapping onto something that's indisputable. I do think there is, you've mentioned it, a little more complexity when it comes to real names and faces, you know, in the church, but maybe, I don't know. I hope I'm right, but maybe I'm not.
You know, the thing that I just turned back to is we have an amazing gospel, and let us not compromise it with these idolatries. And look, idolatries are idolatries for a reason. They're attractive. They have a bait to them. They promise you things that they can't deliver. Like Trump can't deliver.
Right.
Biden can't deliver. Yeah. Jesus Christ delivers us the full deal. And and it's not just like, oh, the third way. It's not just like, oh, we synthesize to get to the Hegelian third. You know, I'm not – there are radical elements to Jesus' kingdom, you know, but they never seem – the world never seems to be able to produce that. And I think one of the things I find really bizarre about America is they really think the president can be like Jesus, like as if there's no sense of like anti-idealism of like, of course, these leaders, it's like, no, they must be like Trump must be the anointed Cyrus or, you know, like whatever. I'm like, where is this coming? Like, you know, and then like seeing apologies from Bethel and being charismatic myself, it's just been absolutely crushing to see the misuse of the spiritual gifts. And you know, already in the UK it's tenuous about how we receive, you know, American-based materials from different churches like Bethel. Like Bethel's had a big influence in the UK, and then when they shifted to being super Trump, or like at least some of their leaders kind of using their platform towards that, it was like again another huge crushing blow, and them not understanding the global church, you know, and being so domestically ingrained in the American context. And I understand, like, there's also a lot of stuff from the extreme left of being very anti-Christian, biblical ethics on some key issues. But I think one of the things I'm really grateful for is the grace to have had the education I have, because it's helped me see through a lot of that and to see that abortion is really complex. You know, the ethics of abortion is really complex. That these issues we simplify in the public sphere that become like lightning rods, that's not actually helping us become an ethical society. That's actually depriving us from the nuance we need to coexist peacefully within a democracy where you have very different opinions on how things should be treated. And I think it's pushed me more into the fact that classical liberalism, you know, is meant to prize this system where you can have radical difference and coexist. And you can renegotiate that every election without a sense of vengeance. You know, Rhode Island, there's a great book, Mere Civility, by Teresa Bejan at Oxford, about the history of democracy and how actually evangelicalism originally was the kind of harbinger of democracy in the sense of this civility, this capacity to live with difference and all try to find kind of democratic consensus and to move forward. So, you know, you can have people who are anti-abortion and who decide, I want to adopt my child out. and that's seen as a legitimate option that isn't threatening other people, like, I want to have an abortion, you know, let these ideas compete within that democratic system. And as Christians, we put our foot behind adoption, and we put our foot behind, you know, caring, like, for women to have as much autonomy as possible with the reproductive reality of their bodies, without, you know, having necessarily to just go down the lifestyle abortion route. Like, there's all these things. It's like, why is this not front and center? Why are we not able to have this nuance with different, very, like, thorny ethical issues? That's the thing that I just keep coming back to, is like, I want to see political leadership that can facilitate our new civility.
Yeah. Well, have you read Jonathan Haidt's work?
The Righteous Mind. Yeah.
So that once I read that, I was like, oh, it all makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not rational creatures. Like, we're tribalistic. Effective. Our intuitions are driving our belief. We rationalize stuff after the fact. We believe what we desire to believe. And there's this looping effect of, like, we want to believe this, so then we find reasons to do it, and then it just, like, reconfirms, and then we have tribal allegiances that reward us when we applaud the tribe. It's so complex, the nature of belief. So it's discouraging, because as a fellow academic, it's like, no, I want to rationalize people out of this ridiculous way of thinking, whatever that might be. And it's like, it's more complex than that, you know?
It is, but I do find it interesting that, the miscibility, the thesis in that book, looking at how what we prize as our values in the kind of West does seem to come from evangelicalism, and yet we are blaming evangelicalism as the problem.
Huh.
And it's really interesting. Every 200 years, you get this cycle where something, you know, like a cultural movement, like evangelicalism, reaches its height, and then it collapses and becomes the enemy. And you see that happening over and over again. So it's interesting. Really? what will come out as the next 200 years, like, what will be the new Christian movement, you know, that defines the age and informs political life? And that's my question, because I think we're at a point where something new has got to emerge, and it's going to take 20 or 30 years at least of kind of the collapse and the, you know, but, like, this has happened before. We're not in some, like, new moment.
Hmm.
Like, there's always been the Catholic Church with the Reformation in the 16th century, you know, and now we're seeing the, you know, the kind of collapse of Protestant evangelicalism at the end of the Reformation, like, kind of cycle. We're seeing that it doesn't work as well as we thought as Protestants. So one of the things I've been searching for is resources that are within the Christian tradition that can help me be the Christian I need to be in this moment, to try to find that the new thing that was really just the old thing.
What have you found?
And kind of that, I think for me, it's been rediscovering what it means to be Catholic as a Christian. And I don't mean that as a capital, mean that as capital C, but a small C Catholic rather than just Reformed. I would say I'm still Reformed. I don't believe in the Catholic doctrine exactly of justification and works. Like, I would be more monergistic and say participation happens after salvation, not as salvation, that, like, it's a monergistic thing from God that's direct, but that there is then a life of participation. The sacraments have become incredibly important to me in suffering and lament and disappointment and the crushing, like, weight of everything, the layers, the intersectional layers of being gay, the layers of the cultural crisis we're in and theological crisis we're in, just all of the things, really. The Eucharist has become incredibly important to me as a place I can just know Christ and know him bodily, like, you know. And I've had a few really amazing mystical experiences taking Eucharist in Oxford in an Anglo-Catholic church. Wouldn't say that I'm Anglo-Catholic, but there's something about that tradition that has resources that evangelicalism has thrown the baby out of the bathwater with. And that's been really helpful. And just the way that Anglo-Catholic people are just so real about their humanity and how terribly they fail all the time. And even to a fault where you're like, come on, like, meant to be like victorious in Christ and like declare the word, you know, and they're like, yeah, well, today, you know, like I'm all over the place. So I'm just holding on for Eucharist, you know, and it's kind of like there's something wrong with that, but there's also something really right with it. And this like just total transhuman messiness. And that's actually part of the incarnation. It's part of the way the word is ordering our human mess. And we have to be real about it with him and finding those spaces where we can do that safely.
Yeah.
I think that's, yeah, there's something growing there for me of really, what does it mean to be Catholic? It means to embrace the full story. Mm-hmm. As evangelicals, we only have the beginning. We're trying to just always go to the beginning, like Bible, Bible, Bible. It's like, yeah, but how is the Bible being received into time in the various challenges of 2,000 years of history for the Christian gospel? And then how does that help us now? And so I think that's where I've gone back to Richard Hooker, the reformer, who tried to find a way through religious wars in England that were tearing the country apart. And his theology was a kind of attempt to move into a middle way, a via media, where there was still some respect for the like Catholic tradition, but there was also like a correction, and it was a resistance from the Puritans, and there was a resistance from like just people who wanted to follow the Pope.
Yeah.
And he had that kind of triad of scripture, reason, tradition.
Yeah.
A lot of people criticize that, especially Barthians, because they're like, there is no natural theology. There's just Christ. And I'm like, so you can just say whatever Christ is then. There's no way of testing, you know, the moral nature of who Christ is. Like Christ is also the creator, and he created a world that has a meaning, and the created order matters. And like in my doctoral work, created orders become really, that there's some divine rationality in the world. And obviously it's through Christ that we access that divine rationality, you know, that helps us discern what to do morally, not just beyond like an injunction in the Bible, like thou shalt not kill, or, you know, but actually when it gets, we're in the rough and ready, like trenches of life.
Right, right.
Yeah, there is this deeper texture to deal with these situations.
I'm hearing some scraping or something when you're.
Oh, sorry.
I'm not sure what it is. If it's your microphone or. Yeah, that may be. Okay.
How's that now?
Okay, cool.
Sometimes I move my hands and it.
Yeah. You're fine. Yeah. can you unpack? I mean, this might take us into your dissertation, which you just are on the latter end of finishing, which I'm super stoked about. The created order and natural law and. Yeah, can you expound on what you've learned over the last few years on that? It's something that I've been more curious about recently.
I wouldn't say, I feel like the more I know, the less I know about this. And I like think it's a really charged area of theology. But I came back from St. Andrews, where I was obviously exposed to a really intense Barthian like approach to knowing truth. And that it was all like top down through Jesus, like Christocentrism bordering on Christomonism, like kind of like God is Christ and that's it. Like, the Holy Spirit just reveals Christ. The Father is just, you know, Christ just reveals himself through Christ. That, like, and then the world had no meaning outside of Christ. So everything's just Christ, to the point where like the whole theological system collapses. And when I went back to Oxford and I started reading Augustine, it like healed me.
Really?
And I was walking around the park and I was like, this world is beautiful. This world was created by God to mean something to us about him. And Christ came to redeem that connection between us, the world, and God. And we are the image bearers. We are the Salem in the temple, in the image of Christ. And of course it's Christocentric. I'm not wanting to undermine that. But this sense of just like our body, sexual difference, the sacral importance of the body, the world, like incarnation, the texture of the good, like the goodness of my physicality being located in a world that matters to God and he loves and he died for. And not just individual souls that were forensically zapped and will one day be raptured away from this horrible place, but like this God who groans in us for the fullness of what this world could be, mm. and that has been revealed in his son. Like, that is so much more beautiful to me than this kind of hyper-Protestant collapse. And so I've tried to regain the world in my theology and say, well, why has God created us the way he has and created the world the way he has? And what is Christ doing to restore the breach of the fall that means we live in an alienated way? And I think this has environmental impacts, and I think this also links deeply to sexual ethics. This is the irony of the political world, is that it's split between environmentalism and sexual ethics. I'm like, these two things are directly related. If we see the world as having an importance, you know, and Tom Wright obviously has impacted me to some degree because he sees the world as vitally important, and that the new creation is a recreation, like a renewing of this creation. And I think he maybe leans too far towards the continuity between now and then. I think there's a lot more to say about the discontinuity as well. Like, it's what is coming is so much greater as well. But just rediscovering that, I think, gave me a very different basis for why I have made the choices ethically that I have with my sexuality, but also why the political world just is not something I feel is in any way in the right about how we steward the creation and how we understand our bodies and our minds and the relationship between the creation and us. So I think natural theology obviously has a problem. Like, I'm not saying that therefore means we can just read the creation and know ethically and morally what to do, which is something we see more in kind of the Thomistic system that I'm a little bit nervous about. I'm like, no, we are epistemically fallen and we struggle to read that world, but somehow by Christ, through Christ and in the Holy Spirit, we're re-illuminated to living in the world according to the way God originally intended it. And that is vitally important for gospel ethics. So there is no bifurcation between kingdom and creation ethics. They are one, you know. Together rather than these two separate things.
In Bart, does Bart downplay the create, like everything you're saying? I read about 100 pages of Bart, have some Bartian friends. I consider myself a more of a Bartian New Testament scholar who didn't read a lot of Bart 15 years ago, you know. So
I mean,
so does he down, is he, and I know him and was it Bruner had that natural law big debate. So does he downplay the role of, how would he describe creation from what you know?
Well, I kind of don't agree with Bruner either, because Bruner thinks you can see ordinances in creation, like marriage is an ordinance of creation. It's just obvious, like all cultures recognize that. I'm like, well, I don't know. I think that's not radically, like, I'm still with the Bartians and the level of, like, I think the point of contact has been broken between human beings and God. I don't think we can know God through the world. But my interest is more, once we know Christ, that should put us back into the world. It should, you know, mean that point of contact is restored and that we can start to participate in the grace of God in creation and that our created nature matters. So, like, I was in a seminar with Douglas Campbell and he said, well, I don't care about this body. Who cares? It's about the resurrection body in the future. So gay marriage is fine. And I'm like, what? Like this like radical discontinuity the other way, which was like very Bartian. And I'm looking at like Tom Wright going, you're a little bit too continuous. And I'm looking at Doug Campbell going, you're too discontinuous. Like, why are we not somewhere in the middle where like, there's something more coming, but this world matters and our sexual difference matters. And, you know, we need to grapple with that. There's like this weird bifurcation in Protestant theology about the world and its nature and our bodies. And so I'm wanting to push against that. And some of that is regaining some of the Roman Catholic things, looking at Eros and Agape and that bifurcation of Eros and Agape in how we understand the metaphysics of love, that really, there is no such thing as like a agape that's spiritual and an eros that is bodily. There's just love. And then there's some Greek words for love that might have like various colors or tints to them. Like eros clearly relates a bit more to like marriage and sex, but eros isn't exclusively in the Greek tradition about marriage and sex. It was about God, knowing God and like being inflamed with divine love. You know,
it has like a passionate, it has like a passion element to it, depending on the context. Could be sexual, could be divine, could be mystical, right? I mean,
and you see in the charismatic movement an attempt to regain that. And then in the reformed world are like anti-eros kind of ethic.
Yeah.
And the charismatics have just like don't have the ascetical maturity to know how to deal with that eros and to test it and purge it and direct it in a healthy, ordered way. And the reformed people like, does it even exist? And there's like this hyper skepticism towards the idea of a celibate gay Christian that could do that, you know. And that produce, or anybody really, men have to be married because they're these horrible, perverse sexual creatures that might just like break at any moment. I'm like, what on earth? And then like, you know, there's a lot wrong, in my opinion, with this whole system. And I'm like, so what do we do? How do we reapproach theologically? Bart, just come back to your question. Bart does have, at the beginning, a bit of a created order theology, but then he turns against it radically at the end and is like, no, and goes the hyper-apocalyptic route with Christology.
Right.
I just think that's too extreme. Like, I read various commentators and people say that Bart thought that Jesus was the sacramentum fide, which means the only sacrament. There isn't, like, taking the bread and wine isn't a sacrament ultimately, like, baptism isn't a sacrament. It's all just Jesus is the sacrament and these things kind of like represent him to us. I'm like, no, I think when I'm taking communion, there's a real presence. There's a consubstantiation going on of some kind. It's a mystery. I can't even forensically explain it, but I love that it's a mystery that is never exhausted by my understanding, you know, and I can just enter that sacrament. And, you know, celibacy is a sacrament because I'm living between heaven and earth and I still experience the incapacity to be celibate because of concupiscence. And yet somehow by heavenly grace, I'm able to give myself up and give my body to Christ and experience this incredible intimacy that we're all destined for. And I live in between, you know, marriage represents that reality too, of the future.
Yeah.
And is a sacrament. Like, what is a sacrament? It just is something of the in-between heaven and earth space that we do to imitate Jesus and his life with the Father through the Spirit. So for me, sacraments have become just so important, like, to everything. I'm like, how have we gotten to this place where we just think sacraments are terrible and anti-evangelical? It's like, anyway, so I suppose I'm not really giving you a very, like, thought through explanation of my doctorate here.
Yeah.
But these are some of my new thoughts that I'm trying to gather after the process.
Okay.
And I don't know what you think, Preston, if you have any further questions or things you want to press.
So it's funny, the gap, people sometimes don't realize this. So I was a biblical studies guy, and then you have theology. And the gap between those two disciplines is so much bigger than the average person realizes. Especially if you do like an American evangelical PhD, they're blended a little more. But you go overseas, and it's my friends that were studying theology under John Webster and stuff. I mean, we can be in the same room for hours and not understand a word any of us were saying. You know, John Webster is more of a dog. I mean, he would come to our New Testament seminars with his Greek New Testament open, and he could hang with the biblical scholars any day of the week.
Amazing.
And we had Francis Watson, who can hang into theology. So we Aberdeen blended it a little bit. But I remember being overwhelmed. I remember reading, is it Catherine Tanner?
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading God in Creation or something. You know, here I am towards the end of my PhD. I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I'm not an idiot either. I'm like, it's a theologian. And I had such a hard time. I'm like reading this and just – and who's the radical orthodoxy guy?
John Milbank.
Yeah, trying to read John Milbank was like – I feel like I'm reading Spanish or Portuguese. I mean, this is just so – anyway, all that to say – when people like you actual theologians start talking, I'm a student. I have nothing to contribute here.
No.
I would like for you to summarize, like, how would you summarize your dissertation? I mean, you've been deep into this topic. What is this topic for somebody who's listening and catching glimpses and pieces, but like, okay, what have you been working on the last few years?
I think my doctorate emerges from the lack of representation of gay celibate Christians within Christian ethics more generally. Hmm. And then it's also got another element of like what I've already discussed in terms of systematic theology, like looking at, you know, Christology, natural theology, like the Trinity. There's definitely that behind it, which comes from kind of Sarah Coakley's work and Oliver O'Donovan's work on kind of resurrection ethics, you know, in a moral order. And then Graham Ward's work, who's the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford, who is a queer theologian. And he's kind of saying that modernism has produced this counterfeit, this parody of the church in terms of intimacy and in terms of erotics. Now, when I say erotics, I don't mean sex. I mean the broader kind of definition that we've discussed. And I think in those three theologians, there are elements of the puzzle to represent gay celibate asceticism, that there is a queerness to gay celibate asceticism, which is trying to critique modernism and say there's counterfeits here, both progressive and conservative, and we're trying to drill down into Christ and his life in Gethsemane, where he says, "Not my will, but yours be done," where desire is like given up to God and then a different mission is received. So it's what's the mission of desire after we give it up, after we ascetically give it to God? And that's really what my doctorate's about, the alternative queerness of Christians giving their bodies up as living sacrifices. That is a queerness that is in many ways challenging to mainstream queerness in the academy.
What to put it in maybe layman's terms, is it almost a critique of like an idolatry of sex that exists both in conservatism, the kind of like if a guy doesn't have sex every 72 hours, he's going to turn into a mad rapist and, you know, their wives need to, you know, just make sure they're giving him release two or three times, you know, in the purity culture stuff, but then also the secular culture where it's like, no, you're not being you if you're not sexually expressing yourself according to your innate desire. Like both of those have a core putting sexual, not sexuality, but sexual expression, sexual behavior, kind of a central piece of human flourishing. In as much as I'm accurate in what I'm saying there, is are you critiquing that kind of narrative?
I am, but I'm trying to dismantle something that has meant the church hasn't produced the theology to actually dismantle that problematic system of purity culture, and then also of the kind of hyper-progressive, just sexual expression is self-expression, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to dismantle and then look at how gay celibate asceticism actually helps the church be itself. Why is it that as a gay celibate Christian, I constantly feel like God is trying to say something through us and we're not being heard? And there isn't the theology to, you know, actually to push back and to create a different, an alternative erotics. That is what my doctor's trying to do. It's called Queering the Queer. How does homosexual celibate asceticism challenge and inform the role of desire in contemporary Anglican theology? I just think Anglicanism for me makes sense because I'm Protestant on some level, but I'm not extreme. And there's so much more deep theology in Anglicanism to deal with this question. Anglican Church has spent a lot of time questioning this, and I really want it to pay off for the whole body of Christ, both Roman Catholic, Orthodox, and Evangelical, outside of the Church of England and Anglican Communion. So trying to do that work, and it's a lot to try to do in 100,000 words. and Augustine obviously plays a huge role, because what Augustine does is find a path through his own time where there were similar debates around desire, virginity, celibacy, and the status of the Holy Virgin, you know. So I'm trying to also draw an analogy between gay celibate Christians and Holy Virgins in the 4th century. And a lot of historical scholars have said that Holy Virgins are queer They had a queer purpose. They disrupted norms. They threw off oppressive understandings of women, where women were basically just, you know, vessels for imperial progeny that could, you know, populate the empire's armies. Like, wow. There was a kind of queer, a breaking open of that norm that was Christian. And I don't think in the secular consciousness there's an idea that Christianity was ever something that actually challenged oppressive systems. And I'm wanting to reclaim that and say gay celibate asceticism is actually trying to do a similar thing to the holy virginity of that time.
That's fascinating.
So yeah, that's my attempt at offering up something that might help the church. It's tough to translate it all to a popular level ethic, but I'm going to work on that afterwards.
I was going
to
say that this is pretty high up there academically. I would love to see a popular level version of it. I mean, because that it's so important, dude. I mean, it's so neat on so many levels. And you mentioned it. Did I catch it in passing that in the last couple of years, maybe since we've talked, like things have gotten harder for side B celibate gay Christians in finding place in the evangelical church? Would that be? I know it's a broad statement, but are you seeing that to be true across the board? Or
I think it definitely has. I think that we've been pretty battered and we've held up a bit, but I don't know. I think the ACNA, the PCA, the like more progressive liberal churches, just being a kind of trophy or like the thing that is kind of abused in both camps is pretty tough. And it's like everyone just wants you to be an apologetic for their cause rather than be challenged back, you know. And there are really good elements of the church that are embracing gay celibate Christians or side B Christians. But it's not as big as I'd hope it to be.
Yeah.
And I think we need more generosity from progressive Christians to say, like, to find a way to have solidarity together without betraying our convictions. And I think that's a big piece that I want to be committed to. But it's really tough when it comes down to like, what does the church actually teach at the end of the day? and the pain that I go through when a church changes its doctrine on marriage is like so intense.
Really?
Are you seeing
a lot of that in the UK and Australia, or more in the UK?
In the UK, yeah. And I think also when churches decide that identifying as gay is somehow wrong is also another blow to healthy discipleship.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think there's so much to say about it. I think I'm in a season where I'm just honestly taking a pause and trying to, you know, prioritize my relationship with Jesus and not be crushed by those things, you know. Yeah.
I'm seeing a mixture of, in one sense, like the demands, you know, the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender is an acquired taste. We, you know, obviously if you're super progressive or if you're far right, you're not going to be calling us. But our demands for our ministry have gone through the roof. Like just, I was like, wow, that's awesome. And when I go speak, you know, I feel like that's getting more and more intense. There's more and more people, more and more demands. So that's all encouraging. People are wanting to engage this conversation in a healthy, nuanced way. And I'm really clear and forthright with my understanding of even gay identity, the term gay and everything. And I get, you know, so I think I'm making some inroads there. People understanding at least the complexity of language and identity, and that's really my goal. Just don't have a simplified, oh, if you say you're gay, you're saying that's your ultimate identity. You know, I don't call myself an adulterous Christian or whatever. And it's like, no, let's understand this a little more. So that's encouraging. Now, there is a discouraging thread is, you know, I've been doing this 6-7 years, you know, and I would love to see churches actually start to take more churches take steps to implement and embody actual might be challenging practices to create a family for all people, single people, married people, whatever, including gay celibate people. It's one thing for people to come and listen to a talk and to come back next year and listen again and come back next year and listen again. It's another thing to take steps to implement. And that's where it's a smaller percentage of churches that I'm getting emails saying, hey, all right, we've done this. We've hired this celibate gay pastor and we've done this. We've lost some people. We've gained some people, but we're doing this. You know, I'm like, man, that's amazing. But that is a smaller number. The gay identity. So I've had more flack so I don't know how many tiers of separation this is, simply speaking at Revoice, which I've done twice. I've gotten more speaking engagements canceled because they found out that I happened to speak at Revoice with no conversation. I could have been speaking at Revoice critiquing, like, I don't even know what I, you know, no, you showed up at Revoice. I heard is liberal or whatever somewhere. That's like the most conservative sexual ethic statement. And then I'm done. No funk, nothing. Just like an email where you're canceled or whatever. I'm like, wow. No conversation? Like, can I get some clarity on this? Or what do you mean when you say gay Christian or whatever? And so I feel like that's almost increasing. And that's discouraging.
I think it's the bunkering down instinct. When people feel threatened by difference, they bunker down into ignorance. And instead of hearing the faithfulness of that, of Revoice people like myself, yourself, you know, yeah. Unfortunately, I think it's the flesh. I think it's the Pharisee. I think it's the thing that comes against the kingdom of Jesus. It's always been there. Jesus had to deal with it. They wanted to kill him. You know, they're going to want to kill us. And yeah. Fortunately, that's humanity, and it's deeply, deeply, like, disturbing. Yeah. It is a form of erasure. Yeah, it's a form of violence. It's really, really horrible. But I think Jesus always had, somehow he rebuked, but he also had his mercy for those who were like that. And I just want to have that mercy. I think it's just really hard to see, though, when I see the impact of it on faithful gay Christians, that I find that really tough. That's when I just lose my mercy and I crack and I say, Jesus, I can't be you. I'm so angry. I'm so exhausted. I'm so disappointed. Help me to step forward. And I think everyone in Revoice, we're just trying to step forward. We're trying to let God, well, my prayer is that God would do it. Like, that God somehow would shift the tide, that we need to pray more, we need to worship. We need to also create a culture where we're supporting each other as side B Christians and not gossiping about each other. I think that's been a really big issue. Okay. People in who are side B taking out their own pain on others, who had maybe got slightly different views within that camp.
Right.
And I think that's really problematic, and we just have to stop that and be generous to each other. But it's understandable when you've gone through the pain and the trauma and everything, and yeah, something's got to change, but it's going to come from the Lord, I think, and not from us. We're not able to do it. It's got to be him, and that's my constant prayer, is like, but I totally know what you mean. Like, I have wanted to speak at Revoice every year. I've been on the speakers list twice, you know, when it's advertised, and then COVID comes and stops me, you know, both times. And I've just been desperate to be at Revoice, to be refreshed and just drink from that well while it's, you know,
beautiful. It's one of the most spiritually vibrant. I'm not as charismatic as you. I'll just throw that out there. When I go there, though, I can say,
I'll just preach the Bible, and then you will be.
Well, I am charismatic. Theologically, I am. You feel the spiritual genuineness and rawness and joy and suffering and lament and authenticity, all just this beautifully complex ball of spirituality. You just, it's just radiating in the room and the conversations, the people you talk to. And this is something in my talk that I said, like, you in 2021, when the conference was last year, you have a you have a Christian who's gay, who has whole swaths of culture wanting them to celebrate and act, you know, whatever, like engage in a same-sex relationship. You have a growing number of churches that are evangelical-ish and teaching the Bible and singing Chris Tomlin songs, and they're affirming. Like, you can go, you have churches. You have everything that's pushing you to embrace an affirming theology. And because of your sometimes very, very counter several cultures, reading of scripture, you're like, no, Jesus, because you're Lord, I'm going to give up something that's pretty significant part of my humanity. I'm going to lay at the foot of the cross because Jesus laid down, you know, I don't want to keep going, but like,
yeah,
to come into a space where they are raising their hands, and I know, and I'll talk to them and say, yeah, this is the first time I've been in a space where I can worship freely, where people know my story, and I feel nothing but like just love and embrace and understanding and camaraderie. Like, to go like that, I just don't, that just, and they're still committed to the traditional view. Like, that, it just blows my mind. And this is what's discouraging for me when people start policing language. And I don't want to, I had a friend that encouraged me that even as I express concern over people policing the language, that there are good people on that side that I don't want to mock them. It can be frustrating when I see people who are basically going affirming because they're just tired of it. They're just like, what? Fine. What else do I need to do now? All right, I'm done. I'm just going to forget it. You think I'm liberal? I'm going to go liberal. You know, that is discouraging to see already a person already on a really narrow road to be told they're not walking a narrow of enough road. That's hard. It's really hard to hear.
Yeah. It's really hard. Whenever I do podcasts on these questions, there's never enough time to describe layers. But I'm just grateful, Preston, that you're willing to kind of stand with us. I just wish there were a lot more. I wish there was more of a coalition that was public of, you know, the more straight pastor leader that was like, yeah, no, we're going to foot revoice. We're going to be generous to progressives as well, because we understand there's been a pastoral crisis. Mm-hmm. People are just trying to get through their lives. Life is hard. You know, let's be generous. Let's not play culture war tactics, but here's our ethic. Here are people living it.
Right.
Here's how we can maybe alleviate some of those layers as a church.
Yeah.
Let's listen. What are the layers? You know, rather than asking constantly like, what are the 3 points that we can do to make our church better place for LGBTQ people? Like, that's important, and we need to answer that question, but it has to be deeper than that. It's got to be like a real listening. And I think the Church of England's actually a good model. They've tried to listen. And I think that there's a lot to learn from that process too, for the rest of the church that's not necessarily Anglican.
Yeah.
So Preston, it's been a wild 2 years.
I know.
Just holding on to Jesus and trying in my own human weakness to, continue with the gospel that we've received.
David, I appreciate you, and thanks so much for giving your time again. Let's not wait 2 years to do this again. But
agreed.
Many blessings on you, the final round here of your dissertation, and I'm excited to see what God does with you in the next 5 to 10 years. Really, thank you for your voice.
Can't wait. Thank you for your friendship.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. God bless.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.